just wanted to clean up a few things from before. Okay, there we are. All right. There are some things that I may not have made perfectly clear, and so I want to go over them again and make sure I make it clear. I have put a lot of focus for the British Baptists on the Old Southwark Church. The Old Southwark Church, as far as we can tell, started in 1650. And it had some very famous men who were pastors. Benjamin Keach, John Gill, John Rippon. The most famous pastor was Spurgeon. And so I have used different names for this church, the Southwark Church, because it was located in Southwark. The Horse Fly Down Church, because that was the section of Southwark where it was. The New Park Street Church, because it was on Park Street, and the Metropolitan Tabernacle, which is where it's located now. Okay. I mentioned Robert Hall Jr., and I said he had a specially outstanding youth group. They would meet together Sunday mornings, Sunday afternoons. They sent the young people all out into the countryside to different towns to have services for churches that had no pastors and that kind of thing. And one day, two of them were walking to this church, and one said to the other, "Well, brother, I'm going to be praying for you as you preach tonight." And the other one said, "I thought you were preaching." And what they finally settled on is one of them was going to preach, and that one that was going to preach was Charles Spurgeon. So that was his first sermon. It was impromptu. And that's where he really got his start in ministry. So that youth group was an important factor in his life. His ministry was in an area where there were a lot of factory workers who had never learned to read. And he thought, how am I going to reach these illiterate people? And so he thought of a way to do it. He devised this book where he could explain the gospel, but without any words. And he called it the Wordless Book, and it was done with colors. And so Spurgeon was the one who originated the Wordless Book, and he did not originate it to reach children. He originated it to reach adults. All right, then I also, well, okay. One of the things that apparently I didn't make sufficiently clear is that the Pilgrims were not Baptists. I mentioned the Mayflower Pilgrims in connection with the beginning of the General Baptists, and I think it got a little bit confusing, so I've done this in a schematic way. It started with a church, an independent church in Gainsborough. This would be in Lincolnshire in England. And the church got to be too big to meet in one place, so they split. Half of them went to Scrooby Manor. Their spiritual leader was John Robinson. A half stayed in Gainsborough, and their spiritual leader was John Smith. So on account of persecution, the Leyden group, the Scrooby Manor group went to Leyden in Holland, and the Gainsborough group went to Amsterdam. And there they found religious freedom, but there were complications. The Leyden group split up, and a part of them went to America on the Mayflower. Their spiritual leader was William Brewster, and the rest remained in Holland. Some of them went to England too. Okay. With the Gainsborough group in Amsterdam, half of them went back to England and became the first General Baptist in England. Okay, Smith came to the conclusion from studying the Bible that baptism was for believers, and so he baptized the people in the church by pouring water over their heads. Okay, at that point, they weren't immersing yet. But once they got back to England, we're not sure exactly when it started, but they started baptizing only by immersion. And that's the beginning, that's the first General Baptists in England. And then the ones who stayed in Holland eventually after Smith died, they joined the Mennonites. Okay, we talked about the Mennonites or the Dutch Baptists. All right. Now, I think I'm ready. Okay, if we can get out of here. Okay, now. We ended last time talking about the downgrade. I think that there's no question, his family certainly believed it, that the downgrade, come on, cooperate here. There we go. Spurgeon called it the downgrade, and he saw three bad characteristics. Abandonment of prayer meeting and a general lack of spiritual vitality in the churches, worldliness among the pastors who spent more time going to the theater than they did studying the Bible, and tolerance of doctrinal error, and of course, the lack of spiritual vitality probably is what led to the doctrinal error. They kind of feed on one another. And so he took his church out of the Baptist Union, and only about five other churches came with him. He had trained several hundred preachers at his pastor's college. They stayed in. And one of his sons was later the pastor after his death, pastored the church, and he led the church back into the Baptist Union. So they just didn't see it. It was a situation where the Baptist Union was 99% good and 1% bad. And Spurgeon said, if you tolerate that 1% bad and you don't do something about it, eventually it's going to be 99% bad and 1% good. Everything that Spurgeon predicted came true, unfortunately. And the Baptist Union in England is no longer a spiritual force. It's full of doctrinal error and compromise. And you wouldn't want to go to one of those churches, at least I hope you wouldn't. Okay. So then the Particular Baptists and the New Connection General Baptist merged to form the British Baptist Union. And, okay. All right, now. Get us up to date through the 20th century. I want to talk about the Metropolitan Tabernacle because it's an exception. Through the years, that church has had some very prominent pastors, two Americans, A.T. Pearson and A.C. Dixon. A.C. Dixon was one of the editors of the famous pamphlet series, The Fundamentals, that came out starting in 1915, that were a great force for good. Pearson was a missionary statesman and a writer, too. W. Graham Scroggie was a famous writer. Those were all pastors at one time or another of the Metropolitan Tabernacle. The pastor today is Pastor Peter Masters, and he's published several useful books, which I've read some of his books. He's just a captivating preacher. I just love to hear him preach. And he's especially effective at reaching university students. The church was just about down to nothing in 1970 when he became pastor. He's been pastor ever since. His assistant pastor is an Arab, and they reach Arabs there that live in that area. He has a reputation, and so university students come, and they come for the purpose of mocking, but his preaching wipes the smirk off their faces, and they walk out serious. So, okay, that's England. And now let's go on to where we should be we are going to talk about Baptist beginnings in America. Baptist beginnings in America were separate from the Baptist beginnings in England. In fact, Baptists in America began at about the same time as Baptists began in England, interestingly enough. And the Baptist in the early years suffered from a lot of persecution, and I think that there are things that we can learn, things that we can draw from their experience that help us as we face the possibility of some genuine persecution here. That's also going to be true when we study the Russian Baptists, but that's for later. First Baptist in America is, the Baptist story begins with Roger Williams. He arrived in Boston in 1631. He had some ministerial training in England. He ministered to congregations in Plymouth and Salem before being banished in January of 1636. Now, he was banished in the winter, and in the winter in New England, if you're banished, there's no hotels, there's no rescue mission, there's no place to go, and that essentially was a death sentence. But some interesting things about Williams included the fact one of the reasons he was banished is he was saying all this nonsense about that we ought to pay the Indians for the land that we want to use. We ought to be friendly with the Indians and negotiate with them so that we can do things that are beneficial to them and to us also. So when he was kicked out in January, guess who took him in so that he didn't freeze to death? The Indians. The reason that he moved from Plymouth to Salem was that the Plymouth church said, we can see where this guy is going. He's going to end up being the same as John Smith. Okay? Remember, they had experience with John Smith before, and they turned out to be right. He founded Providence, Rhode Island, on land purchased from the Indians, and he got a charter from the king to establish a new colony. And he came to Baptist views and was starting to baptize by immersion by 1639. Now, he was a great force for good, but he was a Baptist for a total of about 1 year. He had been trained that in order to be a genuine church, you had to be able to trace a succession from the apostles. And so he was looking for a church that practiced biblical doctrine like the Baptists do. He believed in Baptist doctrine, but he was uneasy about just striking out without the authority of a succession. And he became what they call back then a seeker, which meant that he was looking for a true church that both practiced correct doctrine, taught correct doctrine, correct practice, but also had succession. And of course, he never found that. About the same time, another group of Baptists led by John Clark, who was a medical doctor as well as a preacher, began practicing baptism by immersion in Newport, Rhode Island. And the two of them, Clark and Williams, would change places as governor of the colony for many years. And it was the colony that was founded, Rhode Island and Providence Plantation, was based on complete religious freedom for everybody. Now, a lot of people came to America for religious freedom for themselves, but the Baptists came for religious freedom for everybody. So each made important contributions toward religious liberty in writings. Roger Williams wrote the book, The Bloody Tenet of Persecution, which was obviously was against religious persecution. And Clark wrote a book called Ill News from New England, in which he narrated the story of the persecution of Obadiah Holmes. And if you were here and heard a sermon I preached a couple of months ago, I used Obadiah Holmes as an illustration. And we could stop here for a while and talk about this. There were at least, I think, four people that were put on trial for pretty much the same thing, although they said what Holmes did was the very worst. They were given fines that were way out of proportion to the supposed offense, okay? Their crime was they prayed and sang songs and read scripture with a sick friend, but that was an illegal religious service, okay? It was not authorized by the state church. So people offered to pay the fines for some of the people who were accused, and all of them paid the fine, and except Holmes, and he said, on principle, I'm not going to do that. So they had a different, they each had a different approach, but God used Holmes' experience as it was written up by Clark, not only in America, but Clark went spent several years back in England, and while he was in England is when he published this book. And so this book was a factor on both sides of the Atlantic. During the 17th century, the Baptists remained a scattered and persecuted sect, numbering fewer than 1,000 members in the 13 colonies. By the end of the 18th century, that's the 1700s, with a blessing of God and strong godly leadership, they became the largest religious group in the United States. The Great Awakening accounts for much of their growth. The Great Awakening did not start with the Baptists, but the Baptists participated in it. The Great Awakening started with Presbyterians. So who were some of the men that God raised up in the 18th century, and what were their challenges? Well, the first one I want to mention is Isaac Backus. He was a pastor of a small Baptist church in Massachusetts, near Plymouth. He suffered imprisonment, the loss of property on account of his stand for religious liberty, a battle that was not won until 25 years after his death. I need to explain something here. Isaac's father had died. He and his mother were staunch Baptists, and they kind of suffered together. He lobbied for religious liberty and the formation of the new country. He was a factor in getting religious liberty written into the Constitution, but he was told by, I think it was John Adams, that you would sooner see the sun stop rising in the east than have Massachusetts give up their state church, their state-established church. And remember this, the Constitution was only about the federal government. It was not about state governments, and state governments were free to tax you to support their state church, and they did. And that happened in the state of Massachusetts. And it wasn't until 1832 that the law was changed in Massachusetts. I've got to go on. I can't. Though his congregation was never large, scores of young men were called into the ministry during his 60 years as pastor of the church. So it was always a small church, but the reason it was a small church is they were always sending people off to minister other places. He traveled extensively promoting revival and religious liberty. So he traveled as an evangelist too, besides his work as a pastor. John Leland was a gifted evangelist whose ministry in Virginia resulted in more than 1,200 converts baptized. He came from New England, but his biggest ministry was spent in Virginia. Like many Baptist and Presbyterian ministers in Virginia, he suffered beatings and imprisonment at the instigation of the established Episcopal Church. Thomas Jefferson was not a Christian. Thomas Jefferson was a deist, which means he believed in the great clock winder God, that God created the universe as a clock and he wound the clock up and then he just lets the clock run by itself. So there's no such thing as miracles. Didn't believe in the deity of Christ. He believed Christ was a good man, et cetera, et cetera. But he was by no stretch of the imagination was he a Christian, and he did not behave like one. Even though he may have had a lot of good political ideas. But he did frequently come and hear John Leland preach. The two of them became friends, and Leland was also became good friends with James Madison, who happens to be the one who actually wrote the U.S. Constitution. And his influence with them caused them to push to adopt the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. So without the Baptists, that probably would not have happened. Two more New Englanders, Shubal Stearns and Daniel Marshall, his brother-in-law, had a huge impact on the southern colonies. They traveled from New England evangelizing as they went, and they ended up in North Carolina. Historian David Cummins, we all know who he is, has well said that we should not call the South the Bible Belt, but the Baptist Belt. That's where it comes from. And that's no small thanks to Stearns and Marshall. They settled in a place called Sandy Creek, which nobody's ever heard of. Very small rural place in North Carolina in 1751, and as soon, in just a few years, they gathered a congregation of 600 people who had to travel 10, 20 miles on Sunday on foot or on horseback in order to come to church. Well, that got old, and so that church started a lot of daughter churches. And then those churches started a lot of daughter churches, and eventually that spread throughout the South. So a lot of the Baptists in the South originated right there. Okay, so then let's go on to John Gano. He became the first pastor of the First Baptist Church of New York City in 1762. That church has had some famous pastors too. You knew Richard Burke, taught at Maranatha the first few years, was in the speech and drama. Richard Burke became pastor of that church later. He just retired 10, 15 years ago. It's had a lot of famous pastors. The first pastor was John Gano. He served with distinction as a chaplain in the Revolutionary War. And I should probably say at this point, virtually all of the Baptist pastors in America supported the Revolution, thinking that this was their best shot at full religious liberty. And of course, they turned out to be right. The only pastor I know of that didn't was a man named Morgan Edwards. Morgan Edwards' father was an officer in the British Army, so that might have had something to do with it. I don't know. He was on good terms with George Washington. In fact, there's a story that's been passed down in his family that he actually baptized George Washington. It's a family tradition, legend. I don't know if it's true or not, but I just throw that out there. After the war, he had a problem because all the men in his church joined the army. There wasn't any church left. So he had to regather it after the war was over. And then he left in 1784. He left the church in the care of his son, Stephen. And he embarked on a church planting ministry in the frontier of Kentucky. Americans were beginning to move west. And as they went to the frontier, they needed churches. So that's how he retired. He retired as a church planter. in the wilderness of Kentucky. Well, this is a good breaking off point, so I think we'll just stop here. If you have questions, I'm available after the service.
Good stuff. Remember those names, because they affect, obviously we can, if we want to say, trace our history. Some of that has direct effect on us at this point as we study some of this Baptist history. That's great. Let's have a word of prayer and we'll close the evening.